ask any questions with Deerfield.
I'll call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum, and we have a whole bunch of bills to get through today, so we're in kind of a hurry. And the first thing, of course, is the minutes from February 27 and February 28. Would somebody like to move the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Loeffler moves the two sets of minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the minutes are approved. The first bill is Representative Fritz, House File 220. Which one? Oh, 483 is, which one is that? No. Okay, let's, Representative Fritz, do you want to start with 483?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Call my friend up here with me, my co-author.
Representative Fritz, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move my bill that it be moved and sent to the General Registry. Our bill.
Wait, one? She just moved it to the Central General Registry.
I'm sorry, I think we're going to roll it in.
Yeah,
okay. All right, forgot.
So I'll just repeat your motion.
I would like to move the House File 483 to be included in the
laid over for possible
inclusion.
Okay. And do you have an amendment?
I do have an amendment. The A2 amendment.
Do you want to speak to the amendment?
Yes. What the amendment does is it deletes the establishment of the CCHD registry.
So why don't you move your amendment to the A2?
I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
And it just deletes that registry?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, to your bill.
Well, the bill
I
then.
You have another testifier as well.
I also do have, and if there's time and time permits, I would also like to ask the representative to also speak to the bill the way
Fine.
That now that it's been amended, I'll turn it over to him.
Fine. Thank you so much, Representative Fritz and Gerald Lee. This bill's been to a couple committees. Starting to feel like Representative Atkins. not even close. this bill hits home for me, as this bill requires congenital heart defect newborn screening, which is a pulse oximetry test on newborns to screen for what can be pretty much undetected or unprevisely diagnosed critical congenital heart defects. These heart defects a lot of times aren't apparent until around 48 to 72 hours of birth physically, but can be picked up through this pulse ox screening at around 24 hours after birth. My story begins 32 years ago when I was born at Mercy Hospital in Coon Rapids, happy, healthy baby boy. And it was 3 days later, as they were getting ready to discharge me, that I started to cry, and that all the color drained from my face, and my lips turned purple, and my fingernails turned purple, and they took my mom's newborn baby out of her arms, and a swarm of doctors and nurses loaded her baby up into an ambulance and sent me down to Children's Hospital. And the last thing they said as the ambulance was pulling out to my parents was, "We don't know what's wrong, but we think your son might have a heart defect." They followed the ambulance, got to the hospital, and it wasn't until then that they were told that I, in fact, was born with a three-chambered heart instead of a four-chambered heart. At that time, the prognosis was that I'd live to be about 6 or 7 years following that diagnosis. Now, I've through the miracle of science and life, I've had 10 open-heart surgeries. I've been told that I've had 6 months left to live 6 different times. The last time I just said, no, you guys will figure out something, and they have. And but I think what really hits home with this bill is the timing and the detection. I know we have had other testifiers in our earlier committees that have talked about babies, because in 1980 it wasn't uncommon to have a newborn baby and a mom in the hospital for several days before discharge. Mm-hmm. That's becoming, that timeline's shortening every day as we speak. And so as these critical congenital heart defects present themselves and the symptoms manifest, if you've been discharged from the hospital and you reside in greater Minnesota or outside of the metro area, and it once your baby turns blue, if it takes you an hour to get to the hospital, or you call 911 and a helicopter lands on the street in front of your house to take your newborn baby to the hospital, the compounding damage of systemic organ failure as that lack of oxygen wreaks havoc on your newborn. And we've heard some devastating testimony in the last couple committee stops, and that's what this bill aims to prevent. It's 1 in 100 babies born with a congenital heart defect. It's more prevalent than all pediatric cancers combined. It is a prevalent problem, and it's something that can be detected early and significantly improve the chances of your child.
And Mr. Chair, may I just add too, it's a very small, inexpensive test, and we should have been doing it all along, and now we will be able to do that.
So. Okay, are there any questions? I don't see anything. Anybody. So this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Correct.
As amended. And I thank both of you for your testimony, and I can assure you this will be in my version of the final bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate that. Thank you.
And Representative Fritz, you now have 220.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do have House File Number 220. I'd like to move that also for
this
possible
one,
inclusion.
No, this one goes to the General Register.
Okay.
Because
all
there's
right.
No fiscal note in it.
That's correct. And I do have a testifier with me here today again, if I could.
Okay, so Representative Fritz has moved House File 220, and now we'll... As recommended to pass and sent to the General Register, and we have a testifier, and would you state your name for the tape, please?
Yes. Good afternoon, Sir Chair, member committee members. My name is Michelle Wilson, and I'm the Director at Especially for Children Child Development Center in Eagan, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Child Care Association. I want to thank you so much for allowing me to come today and testify in support of this legislation requiring a physician's signature in order to allow child care providers to sleep an infant in any position other than on his or her back. The recent Back to Sleep campaign has offered an enormous amount of education around the risk of stomach sleeping and the benefits of back sleeping, but child care providers in Minnesota are still allowed to place an infant to sleep on their stomach with a note from the parent granting permission. Although many providers are creating policies to prevent this, the difficulty still arises when parents adamantly request an alternative sleep position. Passing this bill, this legislation, will not eliminate every struggle over sleep position, but it will create another line of defense for providers and an opportunity to expose parents to the education regarding the real life and death implications of stomach sleeping. We do realize there may be some opposition to this bill, such as parents should be allowed to have a say in their child's care plan, and parents are the child's first caregiver and they know their child's best. But with all that said, requiring a physician's signature would still give parents a say in the decision and allowing them to seek another perspective in support of their desire to sleep their child in an alternative sleep position, such as on his or her stomach. Requiring a physician's signature would allow one more opportunity for parents to be educated against the risks of stomach sleeping, thus providing a second line of defense. Discussing sleep position with a physician could also bring to light other medical conditions such as reflux that may be impeding a child's sleep. It may also address other sleep issues. All of the sleep issues I've discussed increase the risk, an infant's risk of sudden infant death during sleeping, and educating during prenatal care and during early visits to a child care provider can give a parent information necessary to discuss sleep patterns and options with their physicians at well baby checkups, thus allowing parents to obtain the physician's signature if desired. The goal being that parents would receive further education on the benefit of placing an infant on his or her back and the real danger of stomach sleeping, and ultimately resulting in the parent not choosing to place his or her infant on their stomach. The American Academy of Pediatrics has stated, with the implementation of the Back to Sleep campaign, SIDS deaths or sudden infant deaths have dropped by 50% in the United States. And although sudden infant death syndrome rates are declining, it's still the leading infant cause, it's still the leading cause of mortality for children younger than a year. This accounts for 56 deaths per 100,000 live births. And that's a little strange for statistics, but that breaks down to 2,500 deaths per year. That's 7 deaths per day. And 1 in 5 SIDS deaths occurs while the infant's being cared for by somebody other than their parent. By passing this proposed legislation, we're not taking away parents' rights or underestimating parents' knowledge of their children. What we are doing is creating another step in the process in hopes that parents will have the opportunity to be educated on the benefits of sleeping their child on their back and the risks of sleeping a child on their stomach. The rates of infant deaths are falling, and our goal as educators is to continue that trend and to educate parents in the process. If this legislation can educate even one parent and save even one child's life, it'll be worth our effort. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, are there questions? And all Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had, I think, two quick questions. The first is, this applies to licensed providers only, as I understand it, and is there... Do we just not have control over unlicensed providers? Is that the reason?
Get your name again.
Yeah, Michelle Wilson. And the legislation proposed speaks directly to licensed providers. That's the regulation we would have. It's not issuing, I think it would just affect licensed child care providers.
And is that... Mr. Chair, is that because, thank you, is that because we cannot affect unlicensed providers with a change?
And I actually don't have the answer for that, but we could get that, I could ask.
Okay, and then the second question has to do with the legality, Mr. Chair, of a doctor's signature. Is there any legal implication there for a doctor signing a note? Should a child die of SIDS and a parent could come back and say the doctor said it was okay, or is this, I'm just wondering.
Well, that's a very good question, and as a nurse, I could just answer that. That is a doctor's script or prescription or order is what it is. It's a doctor's order that you receive, and that is pretty much upheld in a court of law. Again, this is a new new order, and I would think that common sense would say that he's following the pediatric, the National Organization of Pediatrics and all of the folks, that have legally taken an issue on this and commented and actually approve of this. So he's following best practices as a physician by signing the order, and that would be, I would think, in the case of a death of a child, that would be it would help the provider, and the doctor then would have, I would think, the recourse to say that he had implemented the order and stood behind it, and that would, although I've never heard of that happening yet.
Okay.
Representative Norton.
And Mr. Chair, the only reason I'm asking, I'm supportive of the bill generally, but the doctor would be writing an order saying not sleeping in the safe way is allowed. And so if a child is, a doctor writes an order saying the child does not have to sleep in that, they can sleep any way they want, the doctor signs that, the parent brings it in and gives it to the daycare provider, and let's say the child should, you know, have the tragedy of dying of SIDS, is then the doctor liable for writing that prescription saying an alternative was allowable? In the past, it was the parent. So the parent was then the one making that choice and the one, and there was no liability for a physician. So I'm just wondering if MMA has weighed in on this, and if they're not, or perhaps their malpractice suits would cover this. I don't know. I'm just wondering the line of...
We have Representative Liebling would like to comment on that.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I asked, I think after the last committee hearing on this bill, I had a conversation with a pediatrician in the hallway about this very thing. And what she told me was that it would be exceedingly rare for a physician to authorize the child to be put to sleep on its tummy, and it would only happen in cases where there's a very rare condition that... It's like a facial deformity or, you know, a head deformity or something that would be really exceedingly rare. So they were not concerned about this at all. The pediatricians are very supportive of this bill. And, in fact, I think when we had the other hearing, the room was full of pediatricians, if I remember.
Yes, it was.
And they were very supportive of this. So I don't really see that that would be an issue. I suppose it could be in the case where a pediatrician might be pushed by a parent to say, go ahead, but I think that would be an extraordinarily rare instance.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Liebling, and I agree with that analogy. And, you know, as just in the, you know, as a nurse following doctor's orders, it's all, you know, it's it would be, I think, very, very difficult for a doctor to write an order just helter-skelter about whether or not, you know, if the mother is pushing and says he won't sleep any other position but his abdomen, if there wasn't a real clinical issue for that doctor to write that order, I doubt very much that he will. And again, it gives that doctor the opportunity to help that parent understand, you know, the sleep position and the need for this, and the anxiety that parents have with their children, with their infants, and this, and it is an issue that parents do have with their children in their sleeping positions. Believe me, I know as a grandmother, I now know the law and follow it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick things. First one was just what Representative Liebling brought up was that are there certain medical conditions or illnesses that the standard practice would be that the only way they can sleep is on their stomachs, and was that testimony brought up, which I think you covered as best you could in the answer. And the other question was, are there documented cases in Minnesota where parents have given a permission to stomach sleep and there was an infant death?
Representative Fritz.
And I'm not sure either. It seems to me that I have read that there was, but I'd have to go back and ask the department to find that. I think that Jerry Kerber had something in some of his findings that their mortality rate. But we could look that up and get it. I'll share that with you.
Okay, and members, this bill has no fiscal note, so we have to move along, but Representative Abler.
I was just going to say that, Mr. Chair. So this was discussed thoroughly in policy, and just to encourage you, so if we stop talking about it, I'd be fully comfortable. If I could move that we stop talking and move on to other bills that do have fiscal impact.
Okay, any other discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of moving this to the general register signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. So.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. Thank you, Representative Fritz and Ms. Wilson. Next, we have the House File 777, Representative Newton.
I'm a Minnesotan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 777 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Go ahead and describe your bill, Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to say it's amazing to hear Representative Babler talk about talking less. Mr. Chair and members, House File 777 is a simple but important and overdue bill. It provides for a 5% rate increase in MA for each of the next 2 years for any intermediate care facilities for the developmentally disabled, and home and community-based services such as the disability waivers, day training and habilitation, PCAs, and private duty nursing. The rate increase is based on the number of occupied beds. People affected are Minnesotans with disabilities. Those developmental and physical disabilities, autism, mental illness, and brain and injuries. The bill calls for a rate increase of 5% and 5% because of over the past 5 years, rates have declined by 0.1%, while inflation has gone up by 9.9%. So that's a 10% reduction in purchasing power. Let me share a few facts and figures here. 97% of the funding comes from government. In other words, providers can't cost shift or raise their prices for additional resources. 79% of all funding goes to staff wages and benefits. The rest is almost all dedicated to training, operations, and fixed costs. Staff turnover is 40%, much due to people seeking higher paying jobs. Each change in turnover in staff costs $2,500 for recruitment and training of the new staff. And I just wanted to mention, in conjunction with this, average staff employee makes $11.41 an hour. That is roughly equivalent to the poverty guideline for a family of four. Many of the caregivers work 2 to 3 jobs to support their families because they are at that poverty guideline. Let me also give you some facts and figures about the people that are involved. For people who have developmental disabilities, mental illness, autism, brain injuries, and physical disabilities, the support they need varies, as many are medically fragile and have difficult behaviors, while others pursue more independent lives, with the support of their caregivers. Caregivers have an enormous responsibility, and their work is difficult and demanding. This bill is for those people, Minnesotans with disabilities and their caregivers. Moreover, it's about quality care and quality of life, and the key to quality is a stable, fairly compensated workforce. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask some witnesses to come down to provide testimony, and they will be available to answer any technical questions anyone may have.
Okay, would the witnesses come forward, please?
Coming up. Yeah. Bruce, you want to come first? Just briefly.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bruce Nelson from ARM. I could say a lot, but I'd like you to hear from people whose lives are directly affected by this legislation. If I might point out one mistake in the bill that was just pointed out to me that we could correct, perhaps, on 3.5, it says 2%, that should be 5%. What this would do is give the managed care entities 2% when the expectation is to pass through 5%, which would give them less money to work with. It should be 5%. If somebody wanted to do
Mr.
that.
Mr. Representative Newton, would you like to make that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to change on line 3.5, where it says 2%, change that to 5%.
Okay, any discussion of that? I see none. All those in favor, signify by saying. Oh,
Representative Loughmire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't disagree with the concept, but I don't think we set managed care rates this way anymore in terms of the competitive bidding and how that's done, and I just think somebody should, before we do our final bill, we should just check in with the department on whether this works or not with that change purchasing. I don't know.
Okay. Then somebody from DHS, we have to, these are testifiers, I assume, not DHS. Then why don't we vote on the amendment, and if it needs to be corrected in the final bill, it'll be corrected. So all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Okay, thank you.
State your name for the table.
My name is Lynn Jensen, and I work for Wingspan Life Resources. In 1998, I discovered something called a group home when Wingspan fell into my lap. I was hired on the spot part-time and soon went full-time. I was 25 years old, a newlywed, had just bought my first home and had dreams of a large family. In the year 2013, I still work full-time at Wingspan, and I love going to my job every day after 15 years. Unfortunately, loving this job comes with sacrifices. In 1998, gasoline averaged $1.03 a gallon. It is up 372%. Beef is up 115%, electricity 165%, eggs 173%, and so on. In 1998, I made $8.87 an hour. In 2013, I make $12.52 an hour. In 15 years, I've increased $3.69, which is a 29% increase. What cost you $100 in 1998 will now cost you $141. That's a 41% of inflation increase, and my pay rate being only 29%, technically, I make 12% less than I made in 1998. It's no surprise that I lost my house. Although I've always known this line of work would never bring me financial wealth or even stability, I have persevered through it because I'm very proud of what I do, and I've held on to the belief that money isn't everything. I wanted a large family, but struggled with the fact that a second child would bring me down to the poverty level. I could have gotten free medical, food stamps through the state, but instead I pay $475 a month for my family's medical premiums. I pay $625 in rent, which I have to share with a roommate because I cannot afford to live alone. Minimum of gasoline, you can imagine, is at least $160 a month, which leaves me roughly $116 a week to spend on groceries and other expenses. When I hear again that there will not be a COLA, I wonder if those who make the decision realize how important we are and how much our families have given up so that we can care for our consumers. You may not be able to see a product that our company makes because what we create shows on the inside. I'm a better person because of the care I give. My son will no doubt be a better man being exposed to these special people. But if I could go back and talk to the 25-year-old me, would I recommend this line of work for her? I honestly can't answer that question. Although Governor Dayton has plans to aim for a COLA in 2016, that isn't nearly soon enough. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, so next we have Mr. Suba.
Yes. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, committee. Thanks for having me here. My name is Sam Suba. I've started working at Dakota Communities in 1995. And when I first started, my intention of working out there was just simply to make a few bucks and move on to my next job, something that would give me more money at that time, I thought. But after working 16 plus years at Dakota Communities, today I can say to you all that what I thought was just going to be a passerby has become stagnant and permanent. based on the relationships that I have developed with the people that I serve and the people that I work with, it's very difficult to turn your back away and walk. And the changes and the commitment that you've made over the years have really kept us going. One thing I always said to myself, that this job that I do, I'm not doing it for the money, because if it was for the money, I would probably be looking for something else. But it has to do with the love and the care for the people that you serve. The last time I remember, Dakota Communities is able to help as much as they can. Since 2008 was the last time we were privileged to get COLA. Now, since 2008, we have not had one penny added to our paycheck. The cost of living, as stated earlier, has gone up. But we continue to stay out there and do the work we do because we care. Most of my co-workers that I work with have more than two, three jobs. I have three jobs. My full-time job is with Dakota Communities, and I have two part-time jobs that I do every other weekend. I have a family, a wife, and three kids. My oldest is now in college, just started. I'm very proud for what Dakota Communities have done, but it could be better. And I sit here today to say that my kids, not one of them, have health care provided for them because I just can't afford it. Because I can't take that money out of my paycheck to provide health care for them. So at this point, we are basically moving on. But whatever happens, we will look the other way. And thank God we are doing so far so good. What I would like to say here is that if you had a master's degree and had 17 years of experience and decided to apply to the Dakota Communities or to this field for work, the maximum you can be offered is $10.70. The last time I checked, that is not enough to even buy you a cup of tea or coffee at Caribou. It is really sad to sit down and say, you know, what can we do? Can we turn our back on those we love? I don't think so. We are here because we care about the folks. And it is a relationship that we have built. And it's always sad to see you walk away. I've experienced a lot of people coming in and out of the home that I work in. For 17 years, we have had so many people coming in. And the next minute, they have to leave because the money really doesn't cut it. So they come in and then they realize that this is not a career path. And then they move on. Some people stay. People like us stay because we have built that relationship. And I think working with individuals with disability is very, very important. For those who don't know, when you work with people and bring smiles on their faces every day, and you turn around and see how happy they are when they hear your voice, it sends a message. It's not just sitting at the computer and typing, is dealing with real crisis and real people. I want to say to this committee, please, look at the disconnect we have. It is very important to see that the money we make and the care we provide are way off base. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I don't see any, so let's go on to the next test. Thank you for your testimony. It was very moving. Next to Ms. Egg and Martyr.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having me here. My name is Peggy Eck, and I am a sister and guardian to two special needs brothers. One of my brothers is in Illinois, which is where my parents had lived. And my other brother is with Dakota Communities and lives in Brooklyn Center. I have spent a lifetime dealing with disabilities and special needs through my family and trying to advocate for my brothers. Right now, both my brothers are in stable situations, but I have seen them go through a lot of turmoil because mostly the turnover that they have to deal with employees and having different people in and out of their lives. I think it's very important for the family and especially for my brothers, to have as stable of an environment as possible. I think $10.70 an hour is shameful. I would really like to see this COLA bill get passed. It's very important. And I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Martyr.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity. I'm a parent of a daughter with disabilities, and she lives in a group home that is serviced by Dakota Communities. She has been in a group home for 33 years. She's now 45 years old. She's a bright, healthy, beautiful, and engaged person, and engaged in her community because of the staff that take care of her. She's totally dependent on the people that we hire and count on to feed her, to dress her, to bathe her, to toilet her, to hold her hand when she walks in the community because she has scoliosis and has a kind of an off-centered balance. She doesn't say a word. She hasn't spoken since she was 2.5 years old. So figuring out what she needs and what she wants is very, very difficult. But the staff that we have are able to do that. You want to talk about a gift. The staff are the gift. What you heard from Sam and Lynn before, that's the kind of people that we have. They deserve to be paid properly. Otherwise, we don't keep them. Longevity of staff is very important to building the relationships with our kids, and because they need to feel safe and secure. And for many of them, including my daughter, it takes a while to build that trust. So keeping people is very, very critical. For the last 10 years, Carla had one staff person. My daughter's name is Carla D. Her staff person was with her for 10 years. And now, within the last 3 years, she's had three different people. And that's because the young people that we hire, they can't live on what we are allowed to pay. We need to pay them fairly and equitably and recognize the value of what they bring to our children. So I hope that you all support this. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I don't see any, so we go on to the next, Ms. Blumster. Yeah. Welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the tape?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify before you today. Hello, my name is Roberta Blomster, and I'm one of the two self-advocate mentors for Merrick, Inc. And I do happen to have copies of my testimony. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 777, which is the cost of living adjustment increase of 5% legislation that would have a positive impact for places such as Merrick for the next two fiscal years. Day training and habilitation programs have not had a rate increase for the last 4 years. Over the past 10 years, DTNHs have had a decrease of 26% when compared to the rate of inflation. Low funding has increased staff turnover, which can have an adverse effect on the quality of care, plus adds to the cost of providing services. DTNHs in Minnesota employ 6,832 people, and because of the rate cuts, their wages have been cut as a result. There have been increased costs in all areas, including transportation, insurance, supplies, staff salaries, and benefits. Quality and access to services must be maintained. I have been a client of Merrick, Inc. for 16 years, and my life has benefited from being at this place. With my current job at Merrick, yes, I get paid for it, and I'm in my second year of the position. I am having a blast working with the other self-advocates at Merrick on a variety of things, from doing PowerPoints for their annual meetings, helping out at the three self-advocacy group meetings on site, even helping them get their short stories ready for site visits at Merrick with their legislators. I really do enjoy seeing the other self-advocates at Merrick just blossom into who they want to be, and it's been a very fun journey. I've been going to self-advocacy meetings since 2005, and I don't know what I would do if self-advocacy was not a part of my life today. For some of you members of the committee, you have constituents who are clients of Merrick. Just think what their lives would be like if you support this legislation. The quality services that they are getting from Merrick would be increasing as a result, and they would even be close to finding their dream jobs, even if it's working out in the community. I urge you to support House File 777. Thanks again for allowing me to testify today, and I'm more than willing to take any questions that you might have.
Okay, Representative Norton, I don't know if you have a question for Ms. Boomster or not, but I know you have a question.
Well, I wanted to thank you for your wonderful testimony and for being a self-advocate and for the other testifiers on this bill. It's very moving, and for those of us who visit homes and I say from ours in our district, we know the fabulous staff that are there and how what a struggle it is for them to stay in the job that they love because their pay is not what it should be. So thank you all for the testimony. The question I had kind of relates just to the bill as a whole, Representative Newton, and part of it was the fiscal note that I was looking at, and it has a cost, and I'm sure Representative Huntley and the committee will struggle with, you know, our once we get our budget targets and how we're going to make all this work, and I certainly hope increases in pay will be part of that. But there's also a local government cost, and so I guess to that end, have we talked about, have you considered how we might make certain that our counties are going to be also given the funds that they need in order to fulfill the needs based on this fiscal note? So I guess I'm just looking at finding out how you're addressing that.
Mr. Chair, and
Representative Norton,
no, I haven't, and I would ask Mr. Nelson if he's had contact with the counties.
Thank you, Representative Newton, Representative Norton. This language reflects previous cost of living adjustments and, I'm sad to say, reductions as well. The way I understand that the money is moved, that it is done at the state level through MMIS. And so there, if that is the case, isn't an extra cost to counties.
So, Mr. Chair, so if I'm understanding what you're telling me is that we in this committee will account for the funds and that we will send the money down to the counties in order to cover the fiscal note in this bill. Is that what I'm hearing you say, or am I misunderstanding you?
Well, in essence, Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, the allocation under the current allocation system, the amount of money that the county receives would be commensurate with an increase for each individual of, in this case, 5%. And I don't believe, and the counties can step up and comment if they wish, that there is an extra duty on behalf of the counties to have that increase through, as I mentioned, the MMIS system. If I'm wrong, I stand corrected.
Anybody here from the counties would like to comment on that? You know, we, if Mr. Nelson, if you would contact them and make sure that this is correct before we get the final bill, it would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, I absolutely will do that and get back to you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a question on the fiscal note. I'm looking under the assumptions, and it clarifies that the bill requires the health plans to provide 5% increases per year in rates to service providers, and the fiscal note accounts only for the cost of 2% increases to the health plans. And the one question I have, number 8 under assumptions says that this proposal can be implemented within existing administrative resources. So if I'm understanding that right, would we not need to find new money in order to fund this? If this can be funded within existing resources, I'm looking for clarification on that. That sure seems like a nice option if that's the case. I'm just wondering about that comment on the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, the amendment that went on would likely increase the amount in the fiscal note. The fiscal note was drawn from the language as originally presented. So I presume there would be an updated fiscal note as this bill moves forward.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mack.
To Mr. Nelson, just briefly as I'll look at this, the amendment, but could you just explain why the amendment or what the amendment did to change the fiscal note?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, as the bill was originally drawn, written, it provided the managed care entities with a 2% increase from what they now receive and pass through. With the change to 5%, they will now be given the amount of money that the earlier section requires them to pass through. So it lines those two up. And you are right, Representative Mack, it would cost more money and add to the fiscal note.
Yep. Okay, so Mr. Chair, thank you. So if I'm hearing you right, it went from a 2% to the plans to a 5%. And so the number on this fiscal note obviously reflects just the 2%. So I just want to make sure I'm following you correctly. So we're looking at an additional 3% increase from what this fiscal note shows us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, that is my understanding. If the department wishes to correct me, it's their opportunity to do that. I should say, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that a very small portion goes through the managed care organizations. I don't know the precise percentage, but the vast, vast majority of the money goes to counties, and so I can't speculate what the impact would be, but it would not be as if we were adjusting the allocation to counties. Okay. That would be significant.
Okay.
Let's see. Representative Abler.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and just a comment to the bill and then some reactions to the questions. I hope there's some way at the end of the day that we can give some relief to this niche of the industry. It's been starving for quite a while for new money. The House position leaving last in 2011 was not to have any reductions. The Senate had a different position. The governor had a different position. The compromise was a point and a half, I think, reduction, which I hated to do. And so just doing some math, I think it's $35 million per biennium for a percent, just as we do our math, as we scale the targeted amount we have. And I hope that at the end of the day that we can do some of this, which is why I signed the bill. I don't think you're getting the 5-5, but that's not my decision, but I'm going to be weighing in to help a little bit anyway. On the county share, I think there's a county share of costs at ICFDDs. And according to that, on page 3 of the fiscal note, it talks about that the state share is 90% of the non-federal share, which means there's a 5% state share. That's what those numbers make up. And the counties are going to need, either absorb it or just pay it. So they'll surely react to that. But I think they should find the money. And if it's a 35, if that's based on a 10%. It's like $900,000 for a 10%, so it's really not a large expense as Mr. Nelson suggested. So,
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Representative Abler. That percentage share applies only to ICF's DD and not to the vast majority of home and community-based services.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we agree. But that's why it's so small. If it was 5% of all of it, it'd be a massive number. But hopefully the counties can agree this is a good way to manage their money, and we'll urge them. I think I'm going to urge them to eat it. But I think it's a good cause, so good luck with your bill, Representative Newton.
Okay, next, Representative Liebling and Loeffler, and we have three more bills to do.
I'm going to pass, Mr. Chair, and let Representative Loeffler.
Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're collecting information to ask DHS for a lot more details so that we can actually move forward on this and understand what we're doing. One of the things that I would note on the fiscal note is on page 2, it notes the payment delays, and I don't recall why CCSA should be delayed 90 days when everyone else is 30 days. I personally think payment delays also create cash flow problems for the agencies that all these wonderful people are employed in. But I don't understand why we treated one so much differently than the others, and if we could get information on that. And then I would just note on page 4 of the fiscal note, it actually details out some of the county costs, and they're much broader than what Representative Abler mentioned. And, you know, these are county property tax dollars, and we have another page in our budget book that shifts, I think it's $9 million onto property taxes. So I think we just have to, as a committee, keep cumulatively keeping track of what we're doing, and Representative Mack and I will be glad to bring that to the property tax division as they're weighing things as well, because, I mean, we just, all the pieces have to fit together. And we have some tools in the tax committee that maybe we can help with, but you know, I think we just need to better understand these kind of things, so that'd be helpful.
Okay, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I just want to thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward, and the art community and all of the folks that testified, great testifiers today. I have a large group of homes in my district and a lot of folks working in them who come to me all of the time asking me to help them increase their wages. We do have quite a bit of longevity, but a lot of them are working 2 and 3 jobs. They're taxpayers. They're paying the property taxes. They're sending their kids to our schools, and they're staying in the community doing a fantastic service. So I hope that we can find the 5% increase in our budget to finally give these folks a decent wage increase. I put them in the same category with the nursing home caretakers. This is the very same type of care that has been underpaid for so long, Mr. Chair. So I do hope that we continue to discuss this and look for the money to give to those caretakers.
Okay, any other comments? I don't see any. So, Representative Newton, your final words?
Mr. Chair, I'd simply like to renew my motion to move House File 777 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus HHS bill.
Okay, that's what will happen. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you.
And next is Representative Dorholt, House File 387. And welcome to the committee. This could be laid over. Yep. Okay. And so I would move House File 387 be recommended pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With me, I have Dr. Christensen from the Minnesota Psychological Association, who's here to testify on behalf of this bill.
Okay, before we start, there is an amendment, the A1 amendment, and I would move the A1 amendment, and I don't, would you like to describe the amendment just briefly?
Sure, this amendment was brought to my attention by DHS as a matter of a technical means to help them, and if this is to be included, it'll help them incorporate this in a much more seamless manner. So I chose to include their advice on this bill.
Okay, all those... Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On 1.3 of the amendment, I am assuming they're implying the second comma.
Representative Dorholt.
Say it again.
Mr. Chair, on line 1.3 of the amendment, page 2, line 20 before the, and it's not there, but I would assume it would be the second comma would make sense for this this edit and amendment.
That would be correct if one of the our staff people from research would repeat that amendment, clarify the amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, on line 1.3 of the amendment, it should say page 2, line 20 before the second comma.
Okay, so the I would move that amendment to the amendment, which would be on line 1.3, before the word comma, it should be second. And with that, that's incorporated into my amendment, so then I would move the A1 amendment as amended. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So the amendment as amended is adopted.
Yep.
And Dr. Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Daniel Christensen. I'm here representing the Minnesota Psychological Association as past president. A little bit of background. In 2007, a number of reforms were put into place, including some reforms related to the provision of mental health care. One provision increased medical assistant reimbursement for critical access providers in an effort to help cope with the difficulty in obtaining treatment and medication for individuals with serious and persistent mental illness. The thinking was that increasing reimbursement for psychiatrists and nurse practitioners would increase availability. At the time, the effort looked at this one need, medication, and didn't look to the other needs of mental health care for the individuals. The lack of inclusion of psychologists in the rate increases meant that more psychologists no longer see patients covered by medical assistance. The availability of psychologists has become problematic, especially in rural and urban areas, for culturally competent providers. This rate inequity is particularly acute for child psychologists. The Minnesota Psychological Association has worked for several years to have psychologists be eligibility for this increased reimbursement in recognition of their important role of treating people with severe and persistent mental illness. Psychologists have unique skills to bring to the treatment of individuals with serious and persistent mental illness, and with the expansion of medical assistance to more adults without children, more skilled providers are needed. If Minnesota wants to ensure that there are a sufficient number of adequately trained psychologists to meet the need, considering them to be critical access providers and reimbursing them appropriately is necessary. We haven't had an increase in reimbursement rates in more than 12 years. Thank you.
Okay, are there questions for Dr. Christensen? I don't see any. So I would, Representative Dorholt, do you have a final comment? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just purely technical. It has nothing to do with the witness. But just Ms. Aves pointed out to me, there was sort of a second error in the amendment. And that is that on line 1.3, it should have said after the second comma, not before the second comma. So basically, we need to move a comma. And I'm not sure how to do that, but I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention. The comma should go after the date, not before. But it's, as I say, it's non-substantive.
Mr. Chair, what the amendment to the amendment should say on line 1.3 is page 2, line 20, after the second comma.
So I would incorporate that into the amendment and into the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Representative Dorholt, do you have a final comment?
Just thank you for hearing us on this. It's an issue that's important to myself as well as someone who works with people who live with serious and persistent mental illness. I've seen the mental health center I work with lose a lot of good folks because we can't afford to hang on to them, and people are missing out on very important treatment.
Okay, thank you. So I would renew my motion of House File 387 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you very much
thank
for
you, Mr.
your
Chair.
Presentation. As amended, I will.
And House File 550, Representative Liebling. Leaving, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 550 be recommended, I think, be laid over to for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. A lot of work is done around this place in trying to do more integrated kinds of care. We've got accountable care organizations now. The model we're moving toward, and one that we've shown time and time again saves costs and gives people better care, is one where we have integration of services. And this is what we're talking about here, a mental health pilot project in Olmsted County that has been moving along, and we hope will show great results and better care for people with mental illness and also save costs in the long term. So integrated care is kind of the name of the game. So I'm going to turn this over now to my testifier, who's going to explain a little bit more about the program.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cook, and would you state your name for the tape?
David Cook. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm the Chief Executive Officer at Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center in Rochester, Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about the importance of the funding proposal for the Clinical Integration Managers, which will be the hub of our integrated care model at Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center. Since 1966, Zumbro Valley has provided mental health and CD services to the underserved and underinsured individuals who are typically covered under Medicaid in Olmsted and Fillmore counties. In fact, 84% of our client base is covered by Medicaid or Medicare. And Medicaid does not adequately reimburse for care coordination services currently for adults, which is why we are seeking funding for these positions. In the past 2 years, we have been in a process to transform and expand our services to an integrated health home model. We have been researching the needs of our clients and have come to understand that they frequently do not successfully access critical services like primary care. We also know that individuals with a chronic mental illness, and many of our patients are SPMI, serious and persistent mentally ill, who do not successfully access primary care and other medical support services, die 25 years earlier than the rest of the population. This is referencing a Robert Woods Johnson Foundation study done in February 2011 called Mental Disorders and Mental Comorbidity. In the past 2 years, we've added on-site pharmacy to increase medication compliance, and also in cooperation with Apple Tree Dental, our clients have access to dental services on-site. Thanks to a grant from Mayo Clinic, we have worked with an advisory group of medical and community providers, including the Department of Human Services and Department of Health, to develop our business plan to add primary care services to our continuum of care. Let me tell you more about why. 70 to 75% of our psychiatric clients have a comorbid medical condition that is not being treated regularly in primary care. Due to many social factors, most of these clients do not successfully access primary care services. For example, in 2011, we had 189 ambulance visits to Zumbro Valley. In 2012, there were 179. That's more than every other day. Some of those were medical, due to medical reasons. Others were psychiatric holds. But we feel that if we could have an impact just on that number, we could experience a significant cost savings to the system. And a lot of times that's not appropriate for that to happen. For example, if I'm a therapist and I'm seeing somebody in my office and they're having a seizure, my real only option is to call 911, whereas if we had primary care services on site, we could call the nurse practitioner. They could come up and potentially stabilize that patient and avoid that trip to the emergency room, which is an additional cost to the system. Lack of primary care services result in many of these clients seeking acute care in the emergency room, which is very costly and may result in higher levels of care that could be avoided. Even for those who do access primary care, the communication between the medical clinic and Zumbro Valley can be delayed and often fragmented. In an example of this, I was talking with the primary care doctors at Mayo Clinic about our model and what we're trying to accomplish. And their comment was, geez, it sounds like sometimes we don't do a very good job with this population. And I think what happens, and what I said, is an individual comes in, they've got a symptom, and you're trying to treat the symptom, which is rightly so, and all these other issues come out about housing and financial problems, domestic problems, chemical abuse problems, and they say, well, why don't you go back to Zumbro Valley for that? And then we have a disconnect. What we're trying to accomplish is for when those things come up, and if we have on-site primary care services, the nurse practitioner can say, let's walk down the hall and talk to your case manager about that and get those dealt with. So that's what we're trying to achieve. The funding for the clinical integration managers is stage one of our project, of this pilot project to add primary care services. These positions will assess all new clients to Zumbro Valley, determine their risk level, personally connect them to providers at Zumbro Valley, lead the care coordination, the critical care coordination meeting that we will have weekly, where that individual, the clinical integration manager, will choose the highest risk cases to bring to that meeting. And all the providers involved in that case will be required to be at that weekly meeting, whether it's the psychiatrist or the dentist or the pharmacist or who's ever involved, mental health therapist, to come and talk about, do we have the right plan? Is this person improving? Do we need to make any changes to this plan? They'll coordinate services internally and externally to address the high needs of the clients, which will probably include specialty services, track progress of the care plan through our electronic medical record so that everybody in Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center can see what's going on with this patient and connect with them about it as they see them. Stage two of our project is an on-site build-out for the clinic, which we've gotten some bids for at this point. And stage three is the beginning of the operations of the primary care services. Let me give you an example of a client that we're talking about, a typical client. Find my notes. This is a 54-year-old female, has major depression, PTSD, anxiety disorder, living with her daughter because she's unable to live on her own. She's suicidal, and one of the main reasons is that her son committed suicide 2 years ago. She has COPD, type 2 diabetes, very high cholesterol, stage 3 heart failure, morbidly obese, and has osteoarthritis. She's on 8 different medications, can't ride the bus because of her anxiety and arthritis, is currently seen every day by either a primary care person or a Zumbro Valley provider. Unless she's accompanied by one of our nurses, which is not reimbursed, she will usually not go to her primary care appointment. If she does go and we're not there, the communication about the appointment is delayed. If we had a clinical integration manager and primary care on site, we could provide the management of these services for this person. We could stabilize her condition. We could maximize communication among our providers and coordinate her medications with the on-site pharmacy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this important issue. I stand ready for questions from the committee.
Yeah. Mr. Cook, you talked about the weekly meetings.
Yes.
Are there social service people there as well, or is that just the medical side of it?
No, the mental health providers in Zumbro Valley and chemical health providers would also be at that meeting. Or the case manager, if they were providing case management services. At Zumbro Valley, we provide a wide range of services, including case management, outpatient mental health, psychiatry, chemical health outpatient. We have residential treatment for adults. We have housing outreach, where the detox center for 13 counties. So anybody that's directly involved with that patient and part of their care plan would come to that meeting.
Excuse me. So you would also be doing the housing part of their needs.
Yes, we do a lot of housing.
And does the fiscal note include any savings that might be generated by what you do?
We know that we're in the process currently of looking at some sample data with Mayo and Olmsted County to look at the total cost of care of 25 clients that we've got so that we can start to get a sense of what that total amount is and start setting metrics for what we think we're going to be able to reduce in those costs over this five-year pilot period. We know intuitively that we will, as I said, I think through the ambulance visits, through reduced ER visits and hospitalizations. But we need to get a baseline, and that's what we're trying to get now from Mayo and Olmsted County, so that once we start, we can monitor that closely and show those reduction in costs. Most of those reductions are going to come on the medical side for these patients because we'll be able to address many of those issues with on-site at Zumbro Valley.
Well, Mr. Cook and Representative Leeway, and I would strongly urge you to do it. You know, and it does cost money to keep the records, but if you can really focus in on this because, in effect, this is a pilot project, and if it works at Zumbro Valley, maybe we can spread it around the rest of the state, but we're going to need to know the numbers that this actually works.
Yes.
Other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our witness. Just to follow up on that, since you're already partnering with Mayo as a and you know other providers who are in that more acute healthcare setting, if you could ponder whether or not you could create some kind of a joint structure so that some of those savings could actually flow into the project, where you know if you're standalone and you know advising. You're not going to be able to do that, and you know I think there's some models for doing that. You might want to check into them.
Yeah. The other questions, comments? Well, so, Representative Liebling, then, did you have a final comment, Representative Liebling?
Well, just thank you, Mr. Chair, for listening to this and to the committee, and I know that the chair was nice enough to put his name on the bill, and this is the kind of thing that we are trying to do all over the state, and this is a good pilot project, and I think your point is very well taken about trying to collect data. We did this in Olmsted County with the chemical dependency pilot that we were here earlier this year already to expand all over the state, because we did find that when you pilot something, sometimes you really do find that there's a good savings and a better way of doing something, and that's what we hope to show here and have this be something that can be expanded. So thank you for hearing the bill.
Okay, the bill then is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And thank you very much for presenting this bill. And thank you, is it Dr. Cook or Mr.
Cook?
Mr. Cook, for your presentation.
Thank you.
And the last bill is House File 358, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move House File 358 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And I'd also like to move the A5 amendment. And what this does is represent the work of our House research staff, DHS, and providers to just mostly clarify the language to make sure it's clearer. I can go through it in detail, but basically that's mostly what it does. It adds a lot of sentences, but that's just to make sure that it's really targeted so that it can, it's clear who's intended, and the fiscal note can then be done based on that.
Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the A5 is adopted. Yeah. Okay. Representative
Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill extends medical assistance coverage to a new set of services that have been evidence-based proven in both the adult population in some instances or in other parts of the country to create a better coordinated system of services for families who have children experiencing significant mental health challenges and to more effectively support that family in dealing with those issues. And the additional services that the bill adds in are certified family peer specialist services. This we've seen in adult services. Having a child who has a severe diagnosis, maybe a psychosis, is a pretty terrifying thing for many families. We think that by having trained peer supports, they'll have someone to confer with, and it will actually take some of the demands off of mental health providers when sometimes you just need a listening ear to help you as you're dealing with this. InReach community-based service coordination, it allows for an emergency department or an inpatient psychiatric unit to actually work more intensively on creating relationships with community-based services so that we can more quickly discharge people and make sure that they're getting the community support services that they need. Family psychoeducational services recognizes the need that the child doesn't exist in a vacuum and that you should be involving the parents in the treatment and advice about how to interact and how to respond to crises and outbursts as they happen. And clinical care consultation means that providers, many times there's co-diagnoses, you have multiple providers being involved, that they actually are reimbursed for talking with each other, so you actually have a coordinated care team. And also adds a pilot project to test out the concept of DHS doing a survey of providers being involved in this area, which I think would be a very useful part of our quality improvement system in managed care, and we think can be done fairly cost-effectively. DHS and CMS right now do electronic surveys of providers. We have them reporting back to us so we can see if this is something that we feel would be useful to move to other areas. And so that's just a really brief summary, and with me I have two people who are much more grounded in this area than I am, Mary Reagan and Alma Marquez from the Wilder Foundation, and if they could just briefly testify, I would appreciate that.
Okay, who's first?
I'd like to go first, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. We're a membership association of providers of treatment services for children, adolescents, and their families. Our 46 member organizations operate over 300 programs around the state, serving children with mental health, juvenile justice, or child welfare needs, as well as homeless youth. As you know, the children's mental health system in Minnesota includes a continuum of services. An example of part of that continuum is called Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, which is a comprehensive package of services, psychotherapy for children and their families, skill development services to restore or develop healthy functioning, and behavioral aid services to provide support for children and families as they practice what they learn in therapy. These services can be delivered to the family's home, in school, or other settings that work for individual families. These services are brought to those families, which allows them, despite the frequent barriers of distance and transportation, to receive the help they and their children need. Unfortunately, these services are not available across the state, not in all parts of the state, nor are they are providers funded to cover anything other than direct services with the children and families. Key activities like ongoing assessment and evaluation, consultation and coordination, as Representative Loeffler mentioned, with other providers, schools, and teachers aren't covered. CTSS providers have no option to get paid for these key activities or to spend time with families helping them understand their child's mental illness and what the treatment options are. In addition, for most of the direct psychotherapy services, the rates are actually lower than they were 4 years ago. We do know what works, and we know about the importance of continuity of care across services. Many of the components of this bill contain provisions that address these critical gaps in the service system. As Representative Loeffler mentioned, clinical care consultation, treatment plan development, and family psychoeducation all represent important services that can eliminate duplication among providers and improve service effectiveness. The addition of family peer specialists and in-reach services will increase family engagement and improve the very critical transitions from hospital to community-based services. And these proposals are really the direct result of a statewide process we went through 2 years ago where we interviewed folks about where the gaps were in the system, especially for the highest needs kids. And we had care coordinators, case managers, families, youth, all kinds of folks involved in those focus groups. And these ideas are what came out of those focus groups. There were a lot more, but we picked a few of the key ones. In addition to the proposals for additional services, I also want to express support for the proposal to survey providers regarding the impact of their interactions with the health plans that manage Minnesota's medical assistance program. As providers have worked very hard to become as cost-efficient and effective as possible, they have ideas and feedback to share with the department that we hope could result in some standardization of processes and cost savings for all. And I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Okay, and Ms. Marquez, but we're running out of time here. Some of us have a caucus meeting in about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today in support of the House File 358. My name is Alma Marquez, and I am a school-based children's mental health therapist with the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation here in St. Paul. Every day I work with children and families with complex emotional behavioral issues. These are the citizens your legislation will most directly impact. I am here in support of the proposed legislation that includes mental health care coordination and clinical case consultation for children and adolescents. In order to do our jobs well, therapists need to actively communicate with many people, primary care doctors, psychiatrists, family members, and school staff. We do this to prevent relapse and further deterioration. This year, I am working in an innovative service created by a partnership between Wilder Foundation and St. Paul Public Schools. I deliver mental health care at an elementary school with the expectation that I spend as much time doing care coordination and clinical case consultation as each child needs. As a result, children are stabilizing in shorter time frames and are experiencing success in less intense services. I'd like to share one of these examples with you. In September, I met a 6-year-old first grade boy who the classroom teacher referred for services because of risky behaviors like running out of class, jumping flights of stairs, banging his head against walls. An assessment with his mother revealed a history of traumatic experiences. High-risk behaviors at home, abnormal sleeping patterns, and extreme prenatal exposure to drugs and alcohol. In addition, the child was in significant emotional distress and at times was attempting and intending to hurt himself. It took many hours of care coordination and clinical consultation for this child to finally be admitted to a hospital and later to a day treatment program. After starting the program, it took consistent consultation with a team of psychology nurses, and therapists for me to prepare his school and home environment for his return a month later. When this 6-year-old returned to school, his medication was administered by the school nurse. His classroom had the same crawling tunnel that he used in day treatment for him to take quiet breaks. I was able to continue his therapy, knowing exactly where his day treatment therapist left off. His teacher was prepared with the language and strategies for coaching his emotional regulation, and the school social worker had already prepared a plan for completing his evaluation for special education support. We matched the family with a Ramsey County Children's Mental Health case manager to work with mom on future appointments and care needs. I had to be instrumentally involved in coordinating each one of those important pieces. The coordination of care and clinical case consultation with other providers allow children to have all of the adults in their world on the same page, knowing what works for them, what triggers them, what helps and supports successful and safe development. Prior to the start of this unique pilot program, I worked as a therapist in the traditional capacity at Kopi Services for 2 years without the opportunity, ability, or time to focus on care coordination and consultation. As providers, we can do better in delivering mental health services to children and families, and supporting our ability to participate in care coordination and clinical case consultation is the way to do it. I hope you can support this legislation. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for either the two Representative Abler?
Just one real short. What's your credential? To the witness, what's your credential?
Fine. Chair and committee, my credentials, I'm a licensed graduate social worker, so I'm a practitioner that has a professional supervising my work.
So
a master's in social work.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? House File 358 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill as
thank
amended.
You.
Thank you for your testimony, and with that, the meeting is adjourned.